Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Always a pleasure to be able to share this time with you. We begin our program every day with the latest from peer-reviewed literature from the National Library of Medicine, and it shows you that there are thousands upon hundreds of thousands of studies that support a healthier, more natural lifestyle. Now, for example, all over the world throughout history, people have used fermented foods. Now, these are used from the time a child is born, and these are ferments. They're rich in a probiotic bacteria. For example, in South Korea, kombucha, K-O-M-B-U-C-H-A, and kimchi, K-I-M-C-H-I. Now, I cannot handle kombucha. It smells and tastes like rotted vegetables. But when you're raised with it, they love it, and it's very good for them. So there was a study at the University College Cork, which is in Ireland, of which fermented foods are best for your brain. And they looked at over 200 types of fermented foods. All of those were good. That's good news. But then kombucha, you can drink. And by the way, it tastes good because they can blend it with this little tart, but they blend it with raspberries or cherries or strawberries, mint. And so you can buy any number of different types of kombucha tea, or you can make it yourself. And kimchi, well, that's, man, you have to have a really tough disposition to be able to take that, but it's really good for you. Those are the two that are best for your brain. And we know from thousands of studies that a diet that is close to its natural state, what I call a living foods diet, meaning some foods may be lightly cooked, but overall, about 75% of your diet is raw or juiced, like salads. And of course, you're going to have to cook your grains, but it doesn't mean you have to boil them constantly. You can come at low temperatures and add coconut oil, macadamia oil, or mustard seed oil. Those three oils withstand high temperature. So when I'm cooking my rice, adding one part water to one part rice. It normally used to be 2.5 times water to one part grain, but I found that that's not necessary. Cooks overcooks. But then I'll put 1 tablespoon of coconut oil or macadamia oil or mustard seed oil into the blend, and that coats all of the kernels of rice. Therefore, comes out protecting the nutrients in the rice, but allowing you to not overcook it. In any case, when you have a healthy plant-based diet and you're eating lots of nuts and nut butters and seeds, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, sunflower seeds, all of these are good for you. Watermelon seeds has one of the most highest protein values of any seed. Then what you're doing with these fermented foods is you're enhancing tryptophan. That's an amino acid, and it's a key to the production of serotonin, your feel-good hormone. And a messenger in the brain, which influences several aspects of brain function, including your mood. If you have adequate serotonin, you have a better mood. Now, the foods may also contain other brain messengers called neurotransmitters in their raw form. So it's no surprise that when you're eating fermented foods like miso, tofu, tempeh, you're going to have short and long-term benefits, including reducing stress and having a better overall sense of well-being. And it's all good for your brain. That's important. And that was done at 2 different universities. And it's all in the peer-reviewed literature. So just to let you know, get more fermented foods. Now, from the University of Barilia in Spain comes a study about eating just 29 grams of peas, chickpeas, and beans daily. 29 grams is just slightly over an ounce, 28.35 grams to an ounce. So you're talking about like a tablespoon. It's not much. But when you have that, and you have it on a daily basis, you lower your risk of diabetes by up to 35%. Now, if you travel around the world, and I hope you do at some point, give yourself that bucket list before you get old, where you can enjoy it, the culture, the taste, the languages, the religions, the music, everything that a culture provides us that may not be similar to ourselves, but enriches us to know this, experience it. If you go to India, You can go to outside markets that are the size of 2 or 3 football fields. They're huge. Just when it comes to curry, they might have 100 different types of curry. And they have different types of chutney. They have different types of legumes. And legumes and pulses are very big. That's how they make their dal soup, one of the most delicious soups ever. And they have the spices. They might have 200 or 300 different types of spices. Now, they can handle stuff much hotter than we can. Again, they develop it, and it's very good for their blood pressure. It's very good for pain, because there's an active ingredient in those spicy foods that can turn off inflammation, turn off the cytokines in our body. So I also see people who have really beautiful skin, and yet they don't have our diet. It's when they take on our diet, fast food diet, French fries and hamburgers and hot dogs, etc., and pizzas, they suddenly develop diabetes. They're not healthy. But they also don't overeat protein, because most of them are vegetarian. And then some of those are vegan, like the Jains are vegan. So in any case, an article published in the Journal of Clinical Nutrition revealed that individuals who consume just 1 gram per day, that's about 3.35 servings of legumes per week, had a 35% lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes. And you're also getting the B complex, easily digested fiber, calcium, magnesium, potassium, getting all that in pulses and legumes. So make sure you put more of those into your diet. Now, a very good study from the University of Turku, T-U-R-K-U, in Finland, showed that when you exercise, you increase the number of immune cells into the bloodstream, and that fights cancer. Now, if you have cancer, and I've worked with a lot of people with cancer, I make sure that they get into high oxygen and high aerobic exercises, or even hyperbaric oxygen therapy or oxygen therapy by itself, or riding a bike. You've got to get more oxygen in the blood, because high levels of oxygen destroy cancer cells. So it's one way to prevent cancer, and that's why long-distance athletes have a lower rate of cancer than the regular population. But it's also one way, if you have cancer, get out of bed and get aerobic. It reduces the side effects of cancer also, exercise does. So of all the good things exercise does, it does one special thing. It creates more immune cells, which are transferred to the tumor site, and they become more active in destroying cancer cells. There are 2 studies recently published on this very topic. So it's important. Most people don't get enough exercise. And it's especially important for breast cancer. Now another study, and this is from Purdue University, and it talks about consuming protein supplements with meals can work better for weight control. I agree. But I also agree that you should exercise in the morning. Let's say you go for 10,000 step jogging, power walking, then have a smoothie with 1/3 of your serving of protein for the day. For most people, it's going to be about 20 grams of protein. Now, that's very easy to get into a high-quality protein shake. Hemp protein powder, split pea powder, brown rice powder, all different things have protein, amino acids. So when you exercise, let's say when you're power walking, like when I power walk, every step, I clench my fist and release, clench, release, because that pumps blood into the muscles and expands the muscles, especially in your deltoids, trapezoids, pectorals, bicep, tricep, all these muscles in your shoulders and chest become stronger, you burn fat, and then when you have your protein within a half hour after a workout, that muscle that you get initially when you work out, you get a little pumped, and then it goes down. Well, you get it pumped, have your protein shake, and always put a teaspoon of coconut oil, flaxseed oil, a pint of berries, whatever you want, in there. And that really expands the quality of that protein shake. And then that goes into the cell. The branched amino acids go into your cell and gives you more protoplasm, more muscle. You know, it's that simple, not difficult. So make sure you have your first meal of the day is a liquid meal. Try to have 12 hours between dinner and breakfast. And finally, from Poznan University of Medical Science in Poland, they ask a simple question. Do vitamin D levels affect your body's response to anti-cancer immunotherapy? A lot of people have cancer using this particular type of therapy, but the new research indicates that for patients with advanced skin cancer, it is important to maintain good levels of vitamin D3 when receiving immunotherapy medications called immune checkpoint inhibitors. The findings were published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer. So that's the latest on health and healing. A little shorter today because I have a longer interview coming up in just about 10 minutes. I think it's important. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We're going to have a guest here in about, 15 minutes. I think you'll find it very interesting and informed and hopefully very upbeat and positive discussion. And by the way, we got a lot of positive feedback. We were overwhelmed with response from last night's Progressive Commentary Hour. If you didn't have a chance to hear it tomorrow, you'll hear it on WBAI. We won't be live on BAI tomorrow. You'll hear that program from Tuesday night. And it's all about healing energies. And for some, it'll be esoteric. But also, I address the atheist issue. They give their argument, and I give a counter-argument in a way you've never heard before, because I've never shared this outside of a few private lectures. I think you'll find it interesting, and we have one of the best neuroscientists in the world on. Anyhow, that's for tomorrow on BAI, and download it otherwise on prn.live, go to the archives. Here's something to think about. According to a late report out from the Children's Health Defense Fund, quote, the COVID pandemic provided vaccination manufacturers with historic profits in the billions of dollars. Okay. Some of the biggest benefactors of those mountains of cash were the CEOs and top executives. Example, Moderna's CEO, Stefan Bancel, made nearly $400 million last year on his stock options and still owns a reported, this almost seems, I hope it's an error. It says 2.8 billion shares. Wow. That would make him one of the world's wealthiest people, right up there with Elon Musk. And that does not include his salary and perks. You heard me right, $400 million last year. Well, the good news is Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton plans to investigate whether these big pharma companies reap these profits by misrepresenting the efficacy and safety of their vaccines and manipulating vaccine trial data. And I can tell you now, and we've shared it with you, the answer is yes, they did. Yes, they did. And hindsight has recorded the lies stacked up upon lies about the benefits and efficacy of the COVID shots. So that's going to be an investigation. I predict that over the next 2 years, there will be more lawsuits filed in the United States against everyone involved in the pandemic than all the other cumulative lawsuits in American history, because it hurts so many people. Just want to share that with you, and we'll keep you up to date on the latest findings. And by the way, every single day, you're finding out more and more people who were otherwise healthy, no comorbidities, have dropped dead. And the latest is a whole group of bodybuilders. I mean a whole lot of bodybuilders. Over a dozen bodybuilders, top ones in the world, dropping dead. No apparent reason. Well, they all got vaccinated multiple times. So yeah, there's a good reason. And of course, they're going to do everything they can to try to prevent that information from coming to you. But we're going to get it out there to you. So that's that. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to go to two videos. And if you go, and it's easy to watch these videos, and you really should. If you can, and you just go to prn.live, scroll down to shows, then scroll down to Gary Null's archive show and for today, and you'll see it live. This deals with a phenomenon that you may or may not be aware of. On this program, you're aware of it, but most programs you're not. And that is the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, and his whole group have decided the best way to control people is put them into controlled environments. But how do you get the person to go there? Well, you don't. What you do, you take places all over the world, and this is happening all over the world right now as we speak, and you take a community, let's say in Oxford, that's one, but there are many different countries, and these aren't huge cities. These are relatively small cities or towns, and then you make a 15-minute from where that person is to where you can say they have everything they need for quality of life. They have maybe a movie theater, or they have a haberdasher, clothing store, a drug store, a supermarket, restaurant. They have what they need, and they can get there in 15 minutes. They're selling as if this is going to be a great way of reducing carbon emissions. And if you go beyond that, if you take a trip beyond that, even to the other side of town, they might take a town and divide it in half. So as long as you live in your 15-minute section, but let's say your family is in the other 15-minute section, even if they're right across the street, if both of you live on two sides of the street, but the street is the dividing line, that counts as one of 100 you're allowed to take, and then you're fined. Then you have to get permits. Oh, and by the way, in these cities, you'll see something you've never seen in America on these city streets to protect it so it's safe. You'll see these dog-looking robots that are capable of killing someone, and there'll be their handlers there as well. So I guess that people are going to say, that's nice, until a robot goes off and kills a human. Now, you also have to be tagged, and they've come up with a really nice little chip that they can put between your thumb and forefinger. Who cares, right? And then everything about your life, all your bank records, your medical records, your social scores, everything you've got on the internet, every article you've written, photograph you've taken or received, everything about you is in that chip. So let's just say you go into a supermarket and you want to buy something. You have to have that chip activated, and it has to say that you're a good person or you can't buy anything because everything in the store is chipped. And even the refrigeration, you can't open a door to a refrigerator to buy something unless you're chipped. And then in your house, they'll start to apply new smart appliances like a refrigerator. No ordinary refrigerator. It's got a glass door that you see through, but that glass door is monitoring everything you're doing, everything you're saying. They're filming everything. And then they're telling you what you shouldn't buy because it's harming the environment and what you're allowed to buy. But you say, well, hold on. I'm going to do what I want to do. All right, simple. No, you're not. If you buy food we don't believe you should have that contributes to global warming, you're going to get a negative credit score, and we're not going to allow you to buy that. Okay, well, I'll just go someplace else. Good luck getting on a train, a plane, a bus, or even your car, because your car will have a device in it that will not allow you to drive unless we turn it on and off. Everything in your home will be controlled by us. That's the smart meter. So these are the things you're not told about that are actually happening right now as we speak. So I'm going to play the first clip. It's called Welcome to C40 Cities. And then right after that, we're going to go directly from that into 15-minute cities are, quote, an attack on cars, our freedom of movement, and our independence by Alan Miller. I'm sharing this with you for a simple reason, because none of this is unintentional. They need to control you. So if they can control you in the environment which you live now and everything about you, and now they have a new artificial intelligence that can read your brain. So in order to be an acceptable citizen, you have to have thoughts that are acceptable. That means now they'll create the technology to erase the part of your brain they don't want you remembering. You were an activist once. You read Mother Jones once. You read The Nation once. You went to a Gary Nall demonstration, one of 400. Well, that's bad. We can't have you doing demonstrations, not against nuclear power, because we believe in nuclear power. It's clean and green and inexpensive, so cheap it can't even be monitored. No, it's extremely toxic. It's not green. I see. But we want you to all have only a electric vehicle. No. But that's what they want. You'll have no freedoms. And this is happening right now as we speak, and it's coming to America. They're already building. Billionaires are building. Out in the Northwest, they're building a smart city from scratch. So they're going to look at everything that is good and not good, acceptable and unacceptable, in all these other cities, then it's coming to your town. And we're talking about it at a rapid pace, unimaginable. And your local community boards and your city will have no choice in all this. Let's go to Welcome to C40 Cities.
Just once, I'd like to come on here and give you some good news, talk about wonderful things, say that the sun is shining and all the troubles of the world have disappeared. You might have to tune in to The English Couple, my other YouTube channel, for a little lighter relief. But this time I want to talk about something that one of my friendly YouTube channel people who I watch and have developed a nice friendship with, Jeff Buys Cars, alerted me to. A couple of my viewers have also mentioned this, and I thought there's so much to uncover in so many different areas, I'd pushed it to one side. And this is the idea of the C40 cities. We've heard of the 15-minute cities and the 15-minute towns in which the government and the councils want to restrict your movements, prevent you from going across from one zone to another in your cars, by, say, 100 times in a year. We see the tests are going on in Oxford and Canterbury and other places. But the C40 cities is even more worrying. It's run, really, it's an organisation that has at the head of it a series or a membership of mayors. Mayors, you know, the mayor of a town. They're all part of this giant club, I think, across the world. And we have one in this country, in the UK, a number of mayors whose sole job it is to reduce the carbon footprint of their town or city. Sounds very laudable, doesn't it? But of course, it's all gone into this myth about how drastic and catastrophic climate change is going to be for us. The idea is that we reduce the CO2 within the town by a certain amount by 2030. So here we go again, 7 years to flatten the curve. And this time, it looks like they're going to be passing laws and legislation and various incentives for people to, I suppose, change from their heating. Of course, we know about that with the gas boilers, to going into heat pumps, relying on electric heating or electric everything, because we have wind and solar, which is so amazingly marvelous. But it will be restricting our movements. But the main aim will be on the motor cars. In fact, the aim of the C40s is to eradicate all cars from all cities altogether, which is extremely worrying. And the reason is, of course, it's going to be for our sustainable future. It's avoiding the catastrophe that's supposed to be coming to the planet and all this nonsense that we've heard dished out time and time again. Now, I know that there are people who possibly are watching this, and I've had them contact me and going, but Richard, you're wrong. Climate change is a thing. I readily admit that the climate does change. And when you listen to some of the top scientists, they say that actually, yes, it may warm in the next 100 years by 1 to 1.5 degrees centigrade. Which I think, when you consider, particularly in England where I live, the temperature can go from first thing in the morning on an average day at 3 degrees centigrade, and it can rise up to something like 18 or 20 degrees centigrade. I'm not too sure that over 100 years, the general temperature will have risen by 1 degree. It just seems extremely stupid that people have gone to the lengths that they're doing to avoid us supposedly burning up. So they want to eradicate all the cars from all the cities using the mayors to bring it through. So in London, I think it's Sadiq Khan who is the head of the UK division of mayors and is pushing this forward. In London, they have the ULEZ restrictions, which is going to restrict people's movements and charge people a hell of a lot of money to use their cars. There has been a big plan, and I was alerted to this by one of my viewers, in the market town, the ancient market town, I should say, in Shropshire, of Shrewsbury, or Shrewsbury, depending on how you wish to pronounce it. Now, I know Shrewsbury very well. I had a girlfriend up there for a long time, and I was continually going up the M40 in England, past Birmingham, into the West Midlands, where Shrewsbury is. And I know the town. It's a beautiful town with some of these wonderful Tudor houses, you know, the timber-framed houses, absolutely gorgeous, and Georgian properties. It's a remarkable town because it was built in the horseshoe shape, within the horseshoe shape of the River Severn. And you can't really build any more within that. It's developed. It has a castle. It has its park. They have the racing on the river. It's a very beautiful and picturesque town, full of tourists, of course, in the season. And it's a market town. They still have plenty of shops, lots of aspiration, lots of exciting things. There's the Shrewsbury School. Darwin originally lived there. It's got lots of historic connections to it. But the big town plan for Shrewsbury is to eradicate all the roads within the horseshoe shape of the main ancient town, which is riddled with little passages and roads and here's and there's. And yes, okay, during the rush hour, it can get a little bit busy, but nothing compared to what rush hour is down in the south, in Sussex, where I am, or indeed, of course, in Surrey and London and all the satellite counties around it. It's a very peaceful and somewhat laid back town is Shrewsbury. But they want to eradicate all the roads. There'll be park and ride drop off points, and it's going to have the roads pulled up and planted with trees and flowers and be very sustainable. It sounds like a mecca, doesn't it? And I'm sure it will be very beautiful. Except that, of course, if you happen to live outside Shrewsbury and a lot of Shrewsbury and the surrounding area made up of little villages, and people come in and they park up, and there is already places to park outside the village, the town, and you can do your shopping. There's lots of bespoke small businesses in there. There's a few big businesses and supermarkets and what have you. But if you cannot get vehicle access, if you run a business, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to your customers if you buy something that's heavy and bulky that you cannot carry? Or if you're frail and infirm and you can't quite get to one side of the town to the other and you might have taken a taxi? It seems to me that what the aim really is about eradicating all the businesses inside the town and turning everything into flats, because people will not be able to carry out their business. And what you then effectively have done is ghettoised people within the perimeter. And the only way out is on a public service. And again, you're limiting people's ability to travel and enjoy themselves. And this seems to be, to me, what's going on or what's planned for the rest of the country, this sort of thing. Get rid of all motorised vehicles whatsoever. Now, that would be fine if people had voted for it, if people in Shrewsbury and these other C40 towns had said, do you know what, that will be great. We love it. It's a great idea. And if the majority of people, say, I don't know, 75% were in favour, you could see that there would be some legitimacy in this. But like all these things that we're being thrust down, the digital IDs, the central bank digital currency, the net zero agenda, they're just coming down without any of the public having any idea on the whole that it's happening, and not a chance to consult them and have them to vote or give their input or their ideas to perhaps somewhat change what they're saying. It's all being rammed down to us, and nobody, it seems, has got one hope of changing any of it. And so it is obviously about time that people started to realise that this was happening and do something about it. This is, of course, our country. We have the right, surely, to be able to have influence on the places that we want to live. Do we want to be ghettoised? Do we want central governments and the mayors telling us exactly how to live because they're following an agenda that they think is good for us? Who gives them the right to tell us how we should live our lives as living men and women on this planet, on our island. It seems to me that there's one rule for them, as these people will be still jetting about in their private jets, and not a different rule for us. I'd be interested in your comments. If you'd like to find out more, I've left the link to Jeff Buys Cars, in which he...
Now, are you in favour of town planning that ensures your work, your shops, your education needs, your healthcare and leisure are all within a 15-minute walk or cycle ride of your home? On the one hand, the idea sounds benign, but in British cities including Bath, Canterbury, Edinburgh and Oxford, the very idea is being actively challenged by protesters who fear the thin end of a dystopian, totalitarian socialist wedge designed only to strip them of their traditional freedom. I'm joined now by Alan Miller from the Together Declaration, and shortly also by Nathan Albach, an urbanologist from Philadelphia. Alan, thanks for coming in. What exactly is proposed or being pushed in Oxford and the other cities?
So in Oxford, we've had a number of different things. So they keep calling them trials. We've had low traffic neighbourhoods, they said, were trials, even though 65% of people who responded to the consultation said they did not want them. Then you've had a proposal for bus gates. And bus gates, when they've put the proposal, without getting too complex, for the traffic plan for Oxfordshire County Council do, they intertwine that with the idea of a 20-minute neighbourhood. But basically, the bus gates mean you can have 70 passes to drive if you're local, 100 passes a year, but if you're not, you can't, and there's a ring road you have to go around. Slightly different in Bath, where you have a ring of steel, they call it, a very lovely name, and you have low-traffic neighbourhoods as well. And we've seen in other places, like in London, where Ealing, where they've got rid of low-traffic neighbourhoods because residents have challenged it, you still have a discussion about a 20-minute neighbourhood, and we might have some of these road closures as well. So basically, they're a top-down imposition using the idea this would be a lovely livable street, active travel. It's all about people-friendly oriented. But actually, what it means is it's an attack on cars and our freedom of movement and independence.
That is what it feels like, because what I'm suspicious about is the fact that a coercive element is there first. You know, that you know, whatever big flower boxes blocking roads, yeah. Talk of fines for people that use their car on the wrong sort of journey too many times in the year. You'd have thought if it was a naturally utopian, good for the people initiative, people would just naturally inclined towards it without having to be pushed.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things is as well that we've seen in Oxfordshire with the County Council, we've seen that in the consultation, they had a report and a survey done beforehand, but they suppressed it according to Freedom of Information revelations that were in the Times this week and the Oxford Mail until after the consultation ended, because apparently the councillors didn't want people to see what this would mean, would contradict their very own study. A bit like what's happened with Sadiq Khan, it sounds like, with the ULEZ situation. And our point at Together is that why we say free our streets but also take back democracy is that the public should be at the heart of town and city planning, urban planning. What we need in terms of travel, dynamic trade, infrastructure, housing. You know, what happened to local authorities, the idea they would provide decent services? But also, it's not just local authorities, it's central government have been underwriting this and funding it, which is why we've been campaigning, saying to Mark Harper and the Department for Transport, you need to cut this umbilical cord now, because this underwriting of road closures, undemocratically imposed, is damaging businesses. They're being forced to close down. We've seen it on the Cowley Road in Oxford. We've seen it on Middleton Road. 100 years of trade in Middleton Road. Shops having to close. We've seen that in a number of areas across the UK now. And also residents, all types of residents, not what they say, which is conspiracists and far right, but a whole different demographic, diverse, multi-generational, all being impacted in a negative way. And I think that what's going to happen, Neil, is like we've seen in Littlemore and a ward in Oxford, that many more people are going to be standing independently, going to be challenging. Labour won it by a tiny clinch, by 100 votes. They brought out all the guns, lots of people to canvass, but that was a 3 or 4 week campaign that people stood independently. And as these low traffic neighbourhood impositions and as these 15 minute and 20 minute neighbourhoods that are basically a technocrat's idea of what we should do, the great unwashed, how we should travel and not travel, without providing any better provision in any way, we're going to see much more of a fight back, and we're actually supporting people locally, nationally, mm-hmm. To do that alongside launching our cabinet.
bear with me. I've also got Nathan Albach, an urbanologist from Philadelphia, on the line. Nathan, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me, Neil.
Good. No, pleasure to see you. Nathan, do you recognise the version of, let's say, 15-minute cities as described by Alan? And do you are you sympathetic towards the controversies that they have already had form around them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're hitting the nail on the head in terms of the problems of distrust that are arising around the concept of 15-minute cities, particularly around Oxford, have to do with the fact that they came from a top-down level. And I think the policies themselves weren't prescribed transparently or coherently to the public. And I think that's where a lot of these problems come in. And the fact is that all around the world, including parts of the US, Europe, Australia, all over the place, these ideas around new urbanism, this whole concept of building more walkable places that aren't necessarily centered around cars, these ideas have been popularizing. And with that, obviously, governments are finding, you know, ways to kind of meet people where they are in their cities. But I think to be successful in implementing these policies, you have to also work with the residents of an area. And if you don't do that in a transparent way, it's no surprise there's going to be protests.
I suppose the $64,000 question for me, Nathan, is why is it already coercive? You know, what we are seeing here, what Alan's describing, is rather than put in all of these facilities, make sure everyone's got this idyllic world within a 15-minute walk of their home with all of the stuff of life readily accessible, it starts with talk of fines for driving your car too many times in a year and roads being blocked off. Is it for the betterment of people's lives, or is it just to get cars off the road?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to defend the policies around Oxford, because I agree with you in the sense that they weren't really implemented with residents' best interests in mind. I think there's cities all around the world, including parts of the Netherlands, states in the U.S., particularly cities like Portland, parts of Australia like Melbourne, Barcelona has implemented their Superblocks program in recent years. All of these different places have done this from the bottom up in ways where they trial different street designs that include more complete street elements, where they carve out protected bike lanes, they carve out bus lanes, they create raised crosswalks and protected sidewalks and all these different things that kind of like organically build out from starting in city centers that are already highly pedestrianized, and they kind of organically build out from there. And I think that that's where, again, this problem from top-down control coming from Oxford, it's facing these issues at a protest level because, yeah, people, they don't feel like they were part of that discussion. I don't necessarily know the intent of the government officials locally. Like, maybe they had seen some kind of case study and
didn't come from Oxford, didn't come from any of these cities. It came from the World Economic Forum. It's up on their website. Fella, before you go on the media, do your homework. All right? We have all these talking heads, and generally, the person who is leading this conversation is right on top of these issues. And we want to thank him for his good work, but that's a guest I wouldn't have had on. He was way behind the curve. They're working as hard as they can, as fast as they can, to make it seem normal, the new 6G and going up to 9G that's coming. And yet not a single article, not a single commentary, except for this program, and I've done 14 articles, in-depth, scholarly, with all the references showing you the dangers of G1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and Wi-Fi. And yet nothing in the media, not even the alternative media, and that's unfortunate. Because a lot of people are suffering adverse effects from electromagnetic pollution called environmental illness. Just like chronic fatigue syndrome and restless leg syndrome, they said, oh, it's all in your mind. No, it's not. We're going to take a break and come right back with our guest. Please stay with us.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be with you.
The first part of our interview is going to be very short because it's yes and no. The full discussion that you were filmed just this week doing will be posted as soon as our Roland edits it to a let's say like the length of a radio show, because it's the whole hour, and that you're in your own voice not mine, and you're telling your story, which is one that needs to be heard because it can help a lot of people. So yes or no, about more or less 4.5 weeks ago, you gave me a call, the first call in 7 years, and where you said that you were having an emergency. You had been given 10 days to move out of your apartment that you'd lived in over in the east coast of Florida for 13 years. You paid your rent, but the landlord wanted your apartment and you fought him. And unfortunately, at the end, you used up all your resources and you had to move. And you asked, did I have room for you, at least temporarily? Is that true or not?
That's true.
Okay. And I said, sure. So I have a guest house and no one's in the guest house. And it's where my family and friends come when they come to visit me. And I can certainly accommodate someone there and have. And so when you came, on the day you came, you sat down and you handed me a white envelope from a doctor, your current doctor at that time. And you said, I haven't seen this myself. I'm giving it to you unopened and I want you to read it and tell me what it means. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I have the letter here. And when I opened the letter and I read it, I was rather surprised. And so were you, because it seems like you had 8 terminal illnesses. Any one of these illnesses could kill you. You had lung cancer, cervical cancer, endometrium cancer. You had tachycardia. Your resting pulse rate was 105. And to give you an idea, tachycardia with 105, that's really serious, causing strokes and heart attacks. You were morbidly obese at 277 pounds. You had uncontrolled hypertension, 222 over 207. And I can tell you, anyone who has a blood pressure that high and is on a total of 9 medications and they can't control it, then that's a death sentence. You also had uncontrolled blood sugar. Your fasting blood sugar in the morning was 205, and later after you ate, it went up to over 300, and yet you were on multiple blood obesity, blood sugar medications. You also had acute renal failure, and you had an undiagnosed chronic pain in the back that caused you to be in pain 24/7, and you were so in pain you were bent over. You couldn't stand straight. You also had so much mucus coming out of your mouth that your lungs were filled with mucus. And when you tried to walk, you could only walk 5 to 10 feet. You had to stop and sit in a chair because you couldn't get your breath. Is anything I just stated inaccurate or accurate?
Nothing inaccurate.
So I wondered, how was it that this doctor was treating you? And you said, he just gives me drugs. Now, let's go back. Your original diagnosis was one at, I won't mention the name of the doctor or the hospital, but it was of one of Miami's prestigious, most prestigious cancer hospitals. It's like Sloan Kettering in New York or MD Anderson in Houston. And you had the chairman of the department as your personal physician. Is that correct?
That's right.
And when you sat with him after the MRIs were done, what did he tell you was your cancer?
He said that my cancer was cancer of the lung.
At what stage?
And that it was end stage.
Stage 4.
Stage 4.
They
and
did
as you
a,
know, there is no stage 5.
So they did a biopsy and took out a little section of your upper right lobe to determine the type, you know, the type of cancer they were dealing with, correct?
Correct.
Then over the next 30 days, you were in the hospital but received no treatment. They would come in and do blood work up, but you were given an option for surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, and you rejected those. Correct?
Yes.
So you had no treatment for your cancer.
No.
Cancers, and your originating cancer was the cervix and metastasized to the lung. My concern was your pain might have been a metastasis to the spine, which is almost always deadly. And so the first thing I said is you need to have an oncologist, a pulmonologist, a cardiologist. You had problems with your memory. You need a neurologist, and you need a gastrointestinal specialist. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so we began to call, and everybody who was available were months out. They couldn't fit you in, correct?
Correct.
But 2 weeks later, I found you a top-rated internal medicine board certified internal medicine doctor who could then see you. He took his own series of MRIs, blood workups, and confirmed that you had all these conditions in advanced stage. Is that correct?
Yes.
And he would then act as your primary care physician. However, he was just going to wait until the oncologist saw you, and I said to him, I said, she'll be dead by then. I mean, you see these conditions. Have you ever seen a patient your entire career that has all these at the end stage, including her acute kidney failure, and survive? He said, no. But he didn't want to do anything. So I called on, as your advocate, I called your original physician, not the oncologist in the hospital, but the second one. And I had reviewed the physician's desk reference for all nine medications. And I asked him, why did you not explain to her that the number one side effect for three of these medications was acute kidney failure? Because I have her MRIs and her medical records that I got from the first hospital where you got, and you showed them to me, and it doesn't show acute kidney failure. And that's directly from the drugs you gave her. And then you made some excuse. And you told me you didn't know you had acute kidney failure. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so therefore I said, well, how can you justify treating a patient, taking her money and giving her drugs, but not suggesting reduction in salt, increase in potassium, exercise, and other just simple strategies that could lower her blood blood pressure level? And he didn't answer. In fact, when I asked him, how do you justify creating an iatrogenic illness in her when both kidneys shut down, she's dead. I mean, she could try dialysis, but, and was it also true that none of the physicians you'd seen before gave you any hope of surviving?
That's correct.
And so after 30 days of being in the hospital with no help, you just checked yourself out?
I checked myself out.
Okay. So now I'm dealing, as your advocate, with this physician who is not liking my conversation and got rather testy. And I just stayed calm and I just said, if you're a physician, you're legally bound when you're putting someone on medication to check the physician desk reference, see if any of these are counterindicated. And then he started making excuses. Well, you know, she came with different things. And I said, well, show me proof. And he couldn't do it. And that was the end of the conversation. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
And before he hung up, I said, shouldn't you do a new evaluation based upon reviewing what you gave her, how none of it worked, none of it. And her blood pressure continues to be up, her blood sugar up, and her tachycardia increasing. And why don't you see which of these are medically acceptable at this point? At that point, about a day later, you were taking off all your medications. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So then we had a conversation. I said, what do you want to do? Because right now, you need to see all of these board-certified physicians in these different specialties, because that's how medicine works today. But it's going to be 2 to 3 months before you even get into an office. And I said, do you want to just start seeing what you can do by changing your lifestyle? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Here's what I have. And did one of the clinicians who came to see you last night and two other clinicians who've been monitoring your progress, they've all seen a series of four separate blood workups and four separate MRIs in high resolution and definition. So this is not a matter of speculation. This is not a matter of guessing. This is not a matter of hopeful thinking. This is hard 100% scientific proof of what you had before and what you came with and what you have today. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Let me go over this and you just say yes or no. Were the MRIs or the doctors and the blood workup able to find any cancer in your body?
Oh, not the latest, not at all. Nothing.
I'm only talking about the newest one that you just took this week.
No, the newest one shows no cancer whatsoever.
Anywhere in your body?
Anywhere in my body.
You've lost 75 pounds.
That's correct.
Yes, your resting pulse rate went from 105 down to 70.
Yes.
Your blood pressure went from 222 and higher, systolic, and with no medications. What was your blood pressure this morning?
Oh, my blood pressure, I forgot. I didn't write it down to bring with me. But
120 over a 72.
That's correct.
What is your resting blood sugar with no medications, from extreme diabetes uncontrolled to what it is today, where you have had no medication this entire time?
I didn't bring it with me.
68.
But I did tell you what it was. Yes.
You told me 68. This morning. You're taking it every day and recording it. And the clinician last night and earlier in the week on Monday, he took all your vitals. He took blood and to see what your final blood workups and all your blood workups is normal. So you no longer have tachycardia. You no longer have morbid obesity. You're almost breaking 200 mark on your way down to 150, your normal rate. You no longer have diabetes, hypertension, out of control, and your kidneys are functioning fine. From acute kidney failure, they're normal. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And your MRIs and medical exam shows that you actually have stenosis of the spine, and that is being worked on as we speak, and you're getting into physical therapy. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you went from having massive amounts of mucus coming out to having no mucus and able to go from 5 feet of walking to 4 miles.
Yes.
And you're able to stand almost straight up, right?
That's right.
Have I misstated, overstated, or understated anything?
No.
Okay. All right. And now you're about to go on the next step of your journey, now that we've dealt with these medical conditions, and before you even saw any of these specialists. You haven't yet to see a specialist because all these changes occurred prior to seeing a specialist.
Yes.
None of these were medical. These were all lifestyle and behavior modification. Is that correct?
That is very much correct.
Okay. It was not an easy protocol for you, was it?
No, it wasn't. But it was, I was fighting for me and fighting for my life. So I had a vested interest in doing what I had to do to get out of imminent death, no question.
So now you've worked with friends and associates to try to get you an apartment you can afford, and you start your next journey in another couple of days, but at least you're starting that journey, not at death's door.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you, Utrecht.
But thank you, Gary. Thank you.
Okay. We're out of time for WBAI. I'd like to thank you for listening in, and we're going to go to the top of the hour. If you'd like to call in with a statement about anything we've discussed, please do so, 888-874-4888. And also, we managed to expand once again. We were filled up instantly. We managed to expand once again to a different type of platform so we can have another 200 people want to attend this coming Sunday, 1 o'clock's webinar on how to get off the grid, and a lot more. What to do when you get off? What if you're older and have no money? What if you're younger and have no money? What if you have skills? What if you have money? Where do you go? What do you do? What are the places you should do? What should you do with friends and family to explain the changes you feel you need to make? And that you can call in and you can leave, sign up for yourself. 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. So that's good news. That's this coming Sunday, and we're working every day. Richard Gill's going to be on it also, and we're going to have a lot of information to give you. I mean, a lot. How long it'll be, I can't tell you now. It's not going to be one of the super long ones, but you're going to have a lot of insight in your next move in life. And for some of you who've been afraid to move, you've been kind of like a deer in the headlights. You freeze, and then boom, you get hit. And too many people, either for fear or hubris, indifference, or disconnecting from their own reality, they're not going to change anything. And that's their right. But for those of you who want to change, that's also your right. Even if it means family and friends may not like what you're doing, it's your life. And the last time I looked, when you die, all your friends and family who are so certain of your choices don't get in the coffin with you. Yeah? If they had to, if they were wrong, might make a different outcome. In any case, that's going to be Sunday. And also, we have no more room in our health and nutrition retreat, the 14th, in just a week from Sunday, not this Sunday, but the following Sunday. But we have a phenomenal staff coming from around the United States to be with people. And the good news is that we got a found a group to, who are helping sponsor the special nutrients and blood workup. And we got the methylation DNA blood workup marked way down. They wouldn't give it to us for free, which I'd hope, but because we use their patented DNA methylation to tell how old your cells are, how old your organs are, and they came back with phenomenal results that shocked them. And that was with sick people, and people didn't, half the people didn't finish the protocols. That's not going to happen this time. This time we're not allowing the sick people to come in. Everyone's going to be monitored to making sure that they got to do their protocol. So we're expecting, our hope, my hope, is that through methylation DNA testing, we're able to increase a person's life by up to 5 years. That's the hope. And we have, on their study, we did it 2.2 years, but that's with half the people not doing it. So when you're doing an average, imagine, and they said to this in a conference, what would have happened if people, all the people in your study did the protocols correctly? Well, then you're gonna have a whole lot of positive outcome. So we had one person cancel yesterday, so we have room for one person. You can be 50 to 100 years of age and get into the study, providing you don't have cancers and conditions that last time people had. Now, I had to deal with that before I dealt with their anti-aging, and they were only on campus 2 weeks, so that was no easy hat trick, but we did it. This time, we want people who are highly motivated, but we're also doing it from home, and that's a separate story, and we're going to get you signed up. You're going to be the control group. And your blood workup and supplements will also be paid for. However, we're not going to send you any supplements until you do your blood workup, because we've had experiences where people do it from home, don't do it. They have every excuse in the world, but they don't do it. I want people who are willing to do things. I'm going to see in New York, do we have any calls? If we do, we'll take them. If not, we'll wrap up our program.
No, sir.
No calls? Okay, no calls. All right, well, there you've had, and why is it important that you hear her full story where I'm not in it? She's just telling her story for a whole hour. We filmed her earlier this week because this is the second time this has happened. 7 years ago, this happened, and I helped her over a four-month period reverse all of her diseases, but then it came back. So now she's learning that hard lesson. Embrace your dark side, understand its lessons so you can surrender the energy. And then you can go to the light side where you make good choices, healthy choices. You're not going to become obese. You're not going to do anything cause inflammation, which can cause all these different conditions. So we all can only grow as far as what we're willing to surrender from the dark side. And what's the number one thing right now? People acting like they're victims. Because I can't help a person who feels they're a victim. And I won't even try, because it's meaningless, because they're not changing at a life energy level. And it's that level that causes the quantum healing, quantum shift. And I'm going to be going a lot of discussion on this down there for the anti-aging group. And the scientists all over the world, only the scientists who are in the anti-aging, legitimate anti-aging groups, will be able to Zoom in on our meetings each day, because we're setting up a whole filming of this every lecture, and we have great lectures coming in. It's going to be a great time. We have a lot of laughter, fun, and nature, and it gets people a chance, no matter what they are today, to repurpose their life. And Luann's number is 903-881-7008. We're out of time. Let's go over it now to Trice Lead for her program.